I hear all the time about real Americans. Who is and who is not? I hear about it all the time. And as a Native American, I get to listen to a lot of people who are here second and all about their thoughts on immigration all the time. I hear about how they hate DACA or want to criminalize DACA parents. And as a Native person, I would point out that no one really followed the process to get here. But if we choose to play along with human decency, we can choose to make the best us in the U.S. Today's podcast topic is on immigration, DACA, DAPA, and the suggested way forward in the view of an inclusive activist. Welcome back to the podcast. It has been a while since I've been able to record, so I am enjoying the opportunity to sit down to get and talk with you. It's been a good 3 weeks since I've had the chance to sit down and really enjoy a good podcast session with you all. So the podcast experienced a very positive week, but I really didn't run any ads to try to get any new listeners, which was great. But we still saw some very, very strong downloads nonetheless. The last podcast I will have posted as of this particular date is going to be the interview with Eric from Newfound Power. And it has been a minute since I have posted an interview. And those numbers aren't actually really fantastic, even though I thought that podcast was amazing. But it really does seem like those single issue podcasts are more of a hit. So it's nice to see the podcast stand on its own, even with downloads, and even when I don't push it. And tonight, I'm really excited because I have a voicemail. And this is going to be a very nice change of pace. So remember, you can be a part of this podcast as well. You can email me at inclusiveactivism@cox.net or leave me a voicemail at 860-576-9393, and I would love to hear your thoughts. In addition to that, please remember to rate and review this podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or if you could please share the podcast on social media, that would go a really long way to make a huge difference for me and the folks that contribute to this podcast. All those things go a long way to make a significant difference in how viewable this podcast is for others. Please remember to subscribe to our podcasts on iTunes, Stitcher, or Google Play, as these are great ways for me to show proof of work to our potential sponsors. It would go a long way in getting me and my producer, Sarah, paid for our good work in the future too. So please do those things because it makes a huge difference for all of us. And in checking in on my activism, it has been 3 meetings since I have joined the Opportunity of Valley Leadership Advance. This is, again, is a network for people who do leadership in Arizona but are not yet considered pillars in the community. Now, so far, it's been okay. I've made some new friends, and I've learned a lot about the Valley specifically, but I really don't know, like, what the thrust of this is supposed to be or where I'm supposed to go. But I actually am in the middle of the process, so maybe I need to just calm down and let it see where it takes me. I also met with friends to see how we might assist the undocumented and those with DACA and DAPA. We also put on the Civil Conversation Series DACA Allies training, which was really fantastic. I think I had about 94 people show up to that, and so it was really great to see that. One of the sadder things I heard, though, is that Reyna, the person that is the founder of Aliento, told me that some students that go to Paradise Valley Community College were shocked that we would actually hold that or do something like that. So it was sad to hear that they were so shocked, but it was good to hear that we did it. So I kind of had mixed feelings about that thought, but at the same point in time, we did do it, and that is a step forward. I also finished my COM 101 training, which is a series which helps wake folks up, and Diversity Incorporated has started for the year, and I'm really excited about that too. So self-care has been on track pretty well. I've been able to lift 5 times a week the last few weeks, and that has been fantastic. And I have done cardio 2 to 3 times a week. I'm getting a little bit more cardio in that I'm finding ways to do full body workouts, which really push my heart. And so it's that high intensity interval training that is very, very good for muscles and hearts as well. I have meditated at least 2 to 3 times for the last couple weeks and gotten in at least 10 to 15 minutes. I do feel like I need to push into that a little bit more because I think I'm more doing it to do it than doing it with intention and really trying to see what's there. So I do want to see what happens with that a little bit more. And this weekend represents my first full weekend off of work and without any expectations from other folks. And so that's been great. Getting the podcast in is still good, and I'm happy to do those things. But at the same point in time, having a little bit of me time and being able to do stuff on my own schedule, I really appreciate as well. So on to the podcast for today. I wanted to look at immigration from an inclusive activist perspective, and then also give you a native person's perspective on this, as well as some information that I found out there. So first thing, we have to recognize that when it comes to America, North, South, and Central, we are all immigrants. Nobody was here first. We walked here first as native people, but that also means we immigrated specifically. So with that being said, in Western society, the talk is as though Europeans were here first. When people have to migrate, they don't do it for really good reasons. They do it because life is difficult where they are, or they need a new opportunity, or there's no work. No one moves because life is awesome. Because moving sucks, frankly. They move because they desperately, desperately need the opportunity for a better life. And that is why we as Native people originally came to the United States. Now there's many, many different theories on how or why we did so. There's the land bridge theory, or there was a theory of potential exploration. But either way, the folks that chose to come had a yearning in their heart to go to a new place with a new opportunity. And moving is not a fun process, especially when you don't know where you're going to end up. And that's what happens when people typically have migrated to the United States. They've moved, but they don't know exactly what's going to happen or how it's going to turn out. And they need a new place, a new space, and a new opportunity. So when migrants, when refugees, when settlers, etc., they come to the United States, they have to do so for a reason. And I'd like to point out that folks coming from these other countries are not coming here to do so in an exploitative manner. They're not here to just siphon resources off and to send it back home, as is framed in many, many different anti-immigrant arguments. Actually, the folks that did do those are folks that we actually honor here in America. Columbus raped and pillaged and stole and ripped resources out of the ground. Ponce de Leon was looking for the Fountain of Youth. I mean, how deranged was that? But still, like, enslaved and hurt millions of people and exported tons and tons of gold and resources at the cost of many different lives across the original Americas. Their original purpose was to steal, rip, and rob the land as much as possible and kill anyone who inconvenienced that process. So, to be clear, when you're worried about what's going to happen here because of immigrants, it already happened, and we survived it as Native people. That concern is unfounded because you can't live in the same place you pillage, burn, and burn. It's not possible. If you're going to live and be in a new space, you have to take care of that space and all the people in that space, or you're going to try to kill them all off. That's what happened to us as Native people. That's not what's happening here. These folks are looking to live here with us in civil society and contribute and be part of our community. They're not just trying to steal and take things away. They're not just trying to impose their way of life on us. Those false narratives are very problematic, and they don't seek to help us find a positive way forward. Because frankly, there's 11 million people here. We cannot afford to deport 11 million people. And some of those people have been here since they were 2 and 3 years old. Some of those people have been here since they since they came across at 16 as individuals trying to find a better life. We can't afford to give a plane ticket to everybody. We can't afford to lock everybody up. We can't afford to send everybody on a bus. We can't afford to do those things. That's not realistic. Now, the second major topic I want to hit is that from a native perspective, that white and European migration to the Americas represents the worst possible outcome we can experience through a pattern of human migration. And that worst outcome was, frankly, genocide. It has to be called and owned and recognized as genocide specifically. That is not the worst potential outcome that we're looking at here. I've heard a lot about the white genocide that's going on, and frankly, that is not the case. That is not in any danger of happening. White people might be needing to find a way to let more people at the same table they operate at, but that's a huge difference from experiencing genocide. No one's coming in and bashing your baby's heads in with the rifle butt. So, as a native, you need to understand what genocide looks like. You need to understand what genocide does, because this white genocide notion is nothing compared to what we had to experience. Now, as a native, I have had to reconcile my sense of nativeness with my being a United States American at the same time. And I've always had a really, really hard time with this idea and notion, but I heard it best from an eighth grade student at a panel that I was doing on Native American people in education. And this is the gist of what the student said, and as follows. He said, "We don't want to kick you all out. We know the perils of asking for our land back and what it would mean to displace people from their homes. What we want is a recognition of the fact that we as Native people have made and continue to make large sacrifices to create and maintain America as it stands now. All we're asking for is a recognition of that sacrifice." When I heard that, I was just as stunned as you might feel. Now, there's no danger of this genocide outcome happening here. It's not going to be happening with whites with immigrants from Mexico. In fact, it would be of immense benefit for older white retirees or older white folks to look for an influx of a larger workforce into the economy, given the population density being highest with those of us who are older in America specifically. Now, since DACA has been put in place, the average hourly wage of DACA recipients have helped push wages for their work from a low of $10.29 an hour to up to $17.46 an hour. After getting DACA, 80% of DACA recipients got driver's license, and over half of them became organ donors. Again, this is something that's really, really important to the aging population. The fact that there's more and more organ donors out there is going to make a huge difference for our aging community. A lot of people also worry that this is going to harm the community. That is not the case, because those that are here that are undocumented, do consume and contribute to the economy. The Center for American Progress estimated that the U.S. could lose up to $140 billion in gross domestic product over the next 10 years without only DACA folks in the community. Now, if we're to flip that and not just look at DACA specifically, but look at DAPA as well as all other undocumented folks, if we were to look into giving undocumented immigrants a path to citizenship without any path or process, these are the numbers, right? Now, I think trying to, you know, become American, whatever that means exactly, I think showing that you've kind of like helped pay your dues is important. I think showing that you're a productive member of society, that you help, that you're part of the community, right? Like, I don't think you need to assimilate, but I do think you need to like move into being in community here specifically. I think one of the first things we could potentially look at is if you were to pay like $50,000 in taxes, if you had no history of like criminal records of hurting or being of basically just not following community rules, house rules, right? Then there should be a path for folks to come here and live in America specifically. Now, If this path were followed, and I'm not taking in any numbers that would come as far as like people like paying like a fee or whatever to become an American citizen. I'm just talking about this would happen if we allowed the 11 million undocumented folks to become citizens through some path. There would be an eventual boost to the economy of $1.4 trillion in economic growth. This would increase tax revenues to $184 billion. Now, this would be enough to send everyone to college for free. The cost of sending everyone to college for free is about $100 billion. This would also create over 203,000 jobs over the next decade. And this is according to a study done by the Center for American Progress. Now, what's more, Americans, right, not immigrants, this is regular old Americans that are here, would also earn an additional $791 billion in personal income over the same time. So this isn't stuff that just happens to everybody. This is stuff that happens to folks that are already here. The economy would also, in addition, create that 203,000 jobs per year. Within the first 5 years of reform, unauthorized immigrants would be earning 25.1% more than they currently do, and then would thusly generate $659 billion more dollars estimated from now till 2022. That means they would be contributing significantly more to federal, state, and local taxes. Over the next 10 years, that additional tax revenue would be, again, $184 billion, $116 billion to federal governments and $68 billion to state and local governments. Gross domestic product would also increase by $1.1 trillion, and the annual increases in the incomes of Americans would sum up to $618 billion. That is net gain for folks that are already here. That is net gain for all those folks that are worried about people taking their jobs. And I sourced the article I found this information from, so if you're interested in looking out more about those numbers, it's posted in the notes of this podcast. Now, people also worry about the effects of so-called chain migration, that if DACA folks were allowed to become citizens, that they would attempt to gain legal access for their parents as well. Now, in order to do this, this process is not easy. You have to have a job that would fully support you as well as the person that you are trying to bring in. So good luck applying for this potential benefit if you make less than $40,000 a year. The cost in total from beginning and end of this process estimates to be roughly $20,000 with lawyer fees and paperwork. Again, this is money that's put into the economy if this so-called negative impact of chain migration were to take place, and those numbers I showed you before were specifically for everyone, all undocumented folks that are here joining American society. Family-based immigration is not an immediate process. It can take years or even decades for immigrant visas to be made available and processed. Then, once the family member arrives in the U.S. on an immigrant visa, it takes additional time to receive a green card, and that which will denote permanent residency. After that, permanent residents typically have to wait up to an additional 5 years to become U.S. citizens. So again, it's not like people are just going to become U.S. citizens overnight. This is a process. It takes time and it costs a lot of money. That money adds a lot to the economy. And again, that's more money. That's a rising tide that's going to raise all boats. So I looked up some stuff and I found this from Reason.com. And interestingly enough, this Reason.com is more of a libertarian site. So here are the top five reasons why immigration is good for the United States. Number one, immigration is good for the economy. For all the rhetoric about immigrants stealing jobs, immigration actually provides a benefit to the national economy, whether those immigrants have crossed the border illegally or not. Why? Because of what economists call the specialization of labor. As John Hornig, proprietor of the Capitalist Pig blog, explains, the fact that foreigners are eager to pick crops, clean houses, bus tables, and pick produce allows us to afford cheaper food and better services, affording even more wealth to enjoy and invest. It's not the immigrants, but the taxes and spending and entitlements, which most immigrants don't receive, that have drained the economy over time. Now, this assumes that those people keep lower paying jobs. Now, we want everybody to have a good job, because the better job that everyone has, the more taxes that they pay, the more taxes that they pay, the more revenue that's available for us, the collective we, to make our experience here better. And when we're looking at that collective we, those things can be used to help fund free college for everyone, rebuilding infrastructure. All those things need to happen. And without an influx of work and an influx of taxes, I don't know how those things are going to get done specifically. So not only do we want folks here, but we don't want them as second-class citizens. We want them as first-class citizens, and we want as many first-class citizens as possible. The idea that there needs to be second- and third-class citizens is antithetical to the American dream. Now, second, illegal immigrants already pay taxes. One of Obama's remarks on creating a path to citizenship is about paying taxes, and that's another concern that Trump has as well. But most illegal immigrants already do pay taxes. It's been reported that in 2006, an estimated 8 million illegal immigrants, up to two-thirds of the total, paid taxes, including both income taxes, Medicare, and Social Security taxes. Indeed, the revenue from illegal immigrants, and again, I really don't like the term illegal immigrants, it's undocumented people, is estimated to be $11 billion a year in Social Security alone. And that's not even under the pretense of those payments leading to or eventual benefits. Of course, everyone who buys things in the U.S. pays sales taxes, irrespective of their immigration status. And undoubtedly, more undocumented immigrants would pay taxes if they didn't have to worry about possible deportation in the future. Most undocumented immigrants are basically law-abiding folks. While illegal immigration is a crime, and we'll get into the semantics of crime and right and wrong later in the podcast, the act of crossing a border without authorization is merely a misdemeanor. Immigrants, in fact, may have helped to drive crime down. A clear majority want to stay in the country to work and naturally steer clear of breaking any laws. Because if they break any laws, they're most likely going to be deported. So do you see the intense need to follow laws specifically? So they're not speeding, they're not fighting, they're not trying to do anything that's going to cause a problem. And in fact, all manners of violent crime have dropped dramatically since 1986, and this was the last time amnesty was granted to illegal immigrants. Yes, about 14% of federal inmates are undocumented immigrants, but these are largely for immigration violations specifically. On the state level, it's noted that less than 5% of inmates are undocumented immigrants. That is way below what we consider those that are breaking laws or causing trouble in the current population. We're incarcerating quite a bit more than 5% of the population. This is not a crime wave issue. Now, it's also been argued that immigration is a natural and human right. There was a judge, Andrew Napolitano, and he came to Reason.com and argued that immigration is a natural right. And what does that mean? A natural right is a right inherent to our humanity, and the freedom of movement is such a right. The idea that immigration needs to be authorized by the government flies in the face of freedom. Immigrants who come to America seeking the opportunity to work and pursue happiness, or those brought here at too young an age to have any say in the matter, ought to be able to pursue those opportunities. Conversely, employers ought to be able to enter in contracts with any would-be employees as they please. The government doesn't own the country, and political borders are just lines on a map. Treating law-abiding people as criminals simply because they don't meet the bureaucratic requirements of migration abrogates their natural right to travel and Americans' natural right to freely associate and make contracts. And this is point number five. There are basically too many undocumented folks to do anything else. According to last estimates, there again is 11 million undocumented people in America. That is a lot of people. It would be extremely difficult to deport all of them. if not completely and totally impossible. Indeed, even in attempting to do that would require a massive expansion of government bureaucracy, particularly in the form of new government war workers to round up illegal immigrants, process them, and deport them. The inhumanity of this approach goes without saying. Individuals would be ripped from their families and out of our communities, and there would be dire economic consequences, removing millions of hardworking residents from our domestic labor pool. It's time to face the facts. Millions of undocumented immigrants currently residing in the United States are overwhelmingly law-abiding, tax-paying, and hardworking. Grant them amnesty and let them continue to make America a better place. Or great? So again, I got that from a libertarian source, so I'm gonna change everything that says illegal immigrants to undocumented folks. No person is an illegal person, and the idea that a person is an illegal person is ridiculous. So I do apologize for using the term illegal immigrants. Those are just folks with undocumented status. Lastly, for those in love with the idea of law and order and borders, I would say that it is high time that you, American, not so real American, and definitely most likely not Native American, need to reframe the context of your idea of law and order into an idea of what is basically right and what is basically wrong. This is the concern, right? Is amnesty or failure to enforce immigration laws will destroy the rule of law in the United States. So, for a law to be consistent with the rule of law principle, it must be applied equally, have roughly an ante predictable outcomes based on circumstances, and be consistent with Anglo-Saxon traditions of personal autonomy and liberty. Now again, that's what people worry about as far as like people falling into line here, specifically. Our current immigration laws violate all those. They are applied differently based on people's country of birth via arbitrary quotas and other regulations. These outcomes are certainly not predictable, and they are hardly consistent with America's traditional immigration policy and our own personal concepts of liberty. For the rule of law to be present, good laws are required, not just strict adherence to government enforcement of impossible to follow rules. An amnesty is an admission that our past laws have failed and they need reform. The net cost of enforcing these rules in the meantime clearly will exceed those benefits. That's why there have been numerous amnesties throughout American history. Enforcing laws that are inherently capricious are contrary to our traditions and is inconsistent with a stable rule of law that is necessary. Although it is not sufficient, but is a precondition for economic growth. Enforcing bad laws is better than enforcing bad laws uniformly, despite the uncertainty. And as far as immigration, I would say poor enforcement of our destructive laws is preferable to strict enforcement, but liberalization is the best choice of all. Admitting our laws failed and granting amnesty for lawbreakers and reforming laws does not doom the rule of law in the United States. It in fact strengthens it. And for those concerned with the idea of national sovereignty, I would also say, by not exercising control over our borders and actively blocking immigrants, users of the argument warn that the United States government will suffer a vital component of its national sovereignty. Users of this argument who explain the U.S. government would surrender sovereignty in this situation. Even in the most extremely open immigration policy imaginable, the idea of total open borders, national sovereignty is not diminished if our government's institutions choose a policy, right? If we choose to do this thing, it doesn't diminish this thing because we did that thing. Now again, I don't know that totally open borders is the best idea, but I'm just using it as a foil to show how this, even in this extreme situation, the argument fails. So how can this idea be? The standard Weberian definition of a government is an institution that is a monopoly on the legitimate use of violence within a certain geographic area. The way it achieves the monopoly is by keeping out other competing sovereigns that want to be that monopoly. Our government maintains its sovereignty by excluding the militaries of other nations and by stopping insurgents. However, U.S. immigration laws are not primarily designed or intended to keep out foreign armies, spies, or insurgents. The main effect of our immigration laws is to keep out willing foreign workers from selling their labor voluntarily to American purchasers. Such economic controls do not aid in the maintenance of national sovereignty, and while relaxing them or removing them would not infringe on the government's national sovereignty, it is not any more than a policy of unilateral free trade. If the U.S. would choose to return to its 1790 through 1876 immigration policy, foreign militaries crossing U.S. borders would be countered by the U.S. military, allowing the free flow of nonviolent and healthy foreign nationals does nothing to diminish the U.S. legitimate monopoly and use of force in the barbarian world. There is also a historic argument that free immigration and U.S. national sovereignty are not in conflict. From 1780 to 1873, the federal government placed almost no restrictions on immigration. At this time, states imposed restrictions on the immigration of free blacks and likely indigents through outright bars, taxes, passenger regulations, and bonds. Many of these restrictions were not enforced by state governments and were lifted in the 1840s after the Supreme Court decisions. However, that open immigration policy did not stop the United States from fighting in two wars against foreign powers, the War of 1812 and the Mexican-American War, and the Civil War. The U.S. government's monopoly on the legitimate use of force during that time was challenged from within and without, but the U.S. government still maintained its sense of national sovereignty, even with this idea of near open borders. The U.S. government was also clearly sovereign during that time period of history. Those that claim the U.S. government would lose its national sovereignty under the regime of free immigration have yet to reconcile America's past of doing just that. To argue that open borders would destroy American sovereignty is to argue that the United States was not a sovereign country when George Washington, Andrew Jackson, or Abraham Lincoln were presidents. We do not currently have to choose between free immigration and U.S. national sovereignty. Furthermore, national sovereign control over immigration means that governments can do whatever it wants with its power, even including to relinquish it entirely. That is still a choice, and that is still exercising that power. It would be odd to argue that sovereign states have complete control over their border if they can't open them up too much. In essence, that is the essence of sovereignty. After all, I'm arguing that the United States should change its laws to allow for more legal immigration, not that the United States should cede all of its power to a foreign sovereign specifically. And at the end of the day, when we're looking at rule of law, we have to look at just and unjust laws. Now, what I said before was a lot of logical explanation of how these arguments make no sense, especially when you look back at American history. We're going to talk today, right now, specifically about what is right and what is wrong. So currently, in the United States, it is illegal to lynch in America. People will say that murder is illegal, but few in a lynching party were the direct murderers. And there is a case that can be made that people who are part of a lynching party could be considered aiding and abetting to murder, and that idea is against the law. However, you have to look historically at what happens. The people who even did the murdering usually were considered not guilty, depending on the size of the crowd. The more people that were involved in a lynching, the better the odds were that the people that did the murdering got off legally, because in the eyes of the people, it was considered right at the time. So we clearly see that this notion of right and wrong being associated with legality makes no sense, because if lynching were considered wrong, there would be a law against this thing. But currently, it's not against the law, and there is no laws on the books. A current example of an unjust law is civil asset forfeiture. Police can take property from you if they suspect it is proceeds from a crime without having to prove that crime. This should be a rule that is considered unconstitutional and also a violation of the due process of law, right? That's still legal, but we all agree it's unjust. We all know it's unjust, and we could potentially prove it's unjust, but guess what? It's a law. Other laws that people tend to break just because they disagree with it are gambling at home and needing a license to sell almost anything. So, you know, the little symbol of American capitalism with the little kids selling lemonade at the corner? Right, they would need a license to do that, technically. We don't tend to arrest those little children, but at the same point in time, technically they could be arrested because they are technically breaking a law in that they don't have a license to sell that lemonade. Laws must evolve in order to be considered just and right. It used to be legal to have a slave. It used to be legal to rape your wife. It used to be legal to beat your children. It used to be legal to kill your own slave. And it used to be legal to deny LGBT folks the right to marry. And remember, last of all atrocities, the ones that indigenous people had to suffer at the hands of unrighteousness, was genocide, was people killing whole nations of folks over and over again through the use of disease, through the use of guns, through the use of beating, freezing, all that stuff, all these things that happened to Native folks at the time was legal. Totally legal in the eyes of the law. Just because something is or is not legal has nothing to do with it being just or unjust. And I think we really need to stop, look at ourselves in the mirror, and recognize that fact. So, in review, the major points of this podcast were: human migration is normal and should be considered a human right. 2, the naturalization of DACA, DAPA, and all other undocumented folks through a proper process would be of enormous economic gain. And lastly, there are just and unjust laws to keep folks as second-class citizens, and that is just wrong and unjust. Just because something is a law does not mean it is just or unjust, and this idea needs to and must evolve over time. So, we have a voicemail.
My name is Elaine, and I'm concerned about I would like to see more people going for peace instead of all this divisiveness. I think that's going to be the end of us if we don't put a stop to it. That's all I have to say.
Well, Elaine, it was really interesting to hear from you. I don't know you, which makes you the first I don't know you caller on the Inclusive Activism podcast. I agree. I'm not a big fan of divisiveness either. I think we do need to be for peace and finding ways to come together. But I also think disagreeing isn't necessarily a part of having peace, right? I think in order to really have peace, we have to talk about our conflicts, talk about our problems, and find ways to solve them for mutual benefit. Peace doesn't mean just being quiet when you have a problem. I'm sure you have somebody you love in your life, right, Elaine? And if they are in conflict with you and you don't talk about the problem, you don't find a way to overcome that problem. And if you're stuck in a place where you're not trying to evolve past the conflict, then you're never going to be in a place where you can really have true peace, right? There's just this tenseness that never seems to evolve. And so while I am pro-peace, I am definitely anti not doing something about a problem. I want to find for us to come together, find a civil way to talk about things, and share about how we could do something better together, rather than just not talk about an issue. So, in summary, Elaine, I am pro-peace, but I'm also pro-conflict resolution. So I'm not trying to create divisiveness with my podcast specifically. I'm trying to help us find a new way to come together better so we can evolve as people and meet the needs of one another in a new and better way. But Elaine, thank you so much for calling. It's been so long since I've had someone call the podcast specifically. And, you know, I don't know that you agree with me or disagree with me specifically, but I can tell that this is something that was really weighing on your heart. And I greatly appreciate the fact that you gave me a call and we had a conversation a little bit about it. So if I answered your question or not talked about what you wanted me to speak on, please call back and we'll talk a little bit more in the future. But thank you so much for calling. And finally, if this made you think of something, if you have a question or even a more shocking critique, just let me know. You can call me at 860-576-9393. You can get a hold of me in the exact same way Elaine just did. And that space is for you to talk back, ask me questions, hit me with scenarios, and I can kind of like either to react to a thing and react to your situation or scenario in real time, or I can kind of talk about it like I did with Elaine here on the podcast. But I really appreciate that people are willing to call. I wish more people would call in the future. And I appreciate Elaine in her patience on waiting for her voicemail being played, because it has been a little bit of time. And as always, if you're interested in booking me or bringing the power of inclusive activism to your organization, you can do so at inclusiveactivism@cox.net. You can learn more about this organization at www.inclusiveactivism.com, and you can get a hold of me on the voicemail hotline by calling 860-576-9393. Rate and review us on iTunes, subscribe to us on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, and please share us out with more folks, because I think we're on the precipice of something great. Thank you, love you all, and I hope you have a fantastic day. We'll be right back.